The following is a paid program on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates. The views and opinions expressed on this show are not necessarily those of this station. The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Good morning and welcome to The Law Show here on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network. We are your hosts, Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. And today we are going to be talking about estate planning for blended families. Now, a blended family is different from your sort of standard family in the respect that one of the parents, either the husband, the wife, whoever it is, has children from a previous relationship. And you're trying to take these parties and create one new family out of the different components. So, Lynn, why is it that blended families need a special kind of planning or a different planning?
They do need special planning, I guess, if you want to call it that. Partly because the family structure can be a lot more complicated than what you're calling the traditional family or the nuclear family that used to be the most common form of family. It's not anymore. These days, like you say, one of the parents can have children from a previous relationship, or both of them can. So it complicates the family structure. And part of it is that some of the arrangements that people had with their previous relationships are not always fully canceled or changed. And they tend to sometimes hold over into the new family, creating issues that people in a first marriage wouldn't have.
Right. When you consider, for example, in my family, my husband was married before and he has a child from that previous first marriage. So that's something that needs to be taken into consideration when we do our planning.
Exactly. So that's what I mean about the relationships and the family structure being more complicated. If neither of you had been married before, it's not an issue you would have. So there tend to be things that, like I said, that carry over into the new relationship.
And that's one of the first questions you ask when people come in for their meeting to get their documents done is, you know, find out who's in their family, if either of the people has been married before, if they have children from previous relationships, whether or not it was a marriage.
Oh, yes, it doesn't necessarily have to be a marriage. You're right. One of the first things before I ask anybody about their plans or their assets or anything is I get a good idea of the family structure, because obviously that's what will planning and estate planning is all about, is the family. So I have to understand the relationships in the family before we take any other steps.
And there are different components to a blended family. You've got the previous spouse or relationship from either side. You've got the current spouse that needs to be taken into consideration. And you've got the children who are involved, whether they're from your previous relationships or your current relationship. Each situation requires its own attention. So we're going to talk about each of these components individually and see how all the different pieces of this puzzle fit together.
Right.
So the first part that we are going to talk about before we get into the new blended family, we're going to talk about the former family. Now, how do former spouses fit into the estate planning puzzle?
If everything has been taken care of from the old relationship, the old spouse, former spouse, should not come into things at all. But what usually happens is things are forgotten or things are not really completely closed off. So, like I said, if absolutely everything's taken care of, then you can walk away and pretend you're never married before. But that rarely happens.
Is that something that's more likely to happen if you didn't have children? Because something like child support surely carries over from one relationship to the next.
It does, yeah. You know, what people do when they get divorced is they sign the divorce agreement and they kind of walk away and they think everything's done. And it's not. And this is something that happens when that person later passes away and it's discovered that a lot of things were never cleaned up from the first one that impacts the second relationship. And now everybody's in court or they're in a dispute about who gets what.
So would that be something like, for example, an RRSP or a life insurance policy?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times when I'm talking to people about what they want, what their plans are for their estate, and And I'll ask them directly, you know, do you have a life insurance policy and who's the beneficiary of it? And they'll say, oh, yes, I have life insurance. And then they have to think about who the beneficiary is. And say they've been in their new relationship for, say, 2 years. And I'll say, have you changed that in the last 2 years? And say, oh, I don't think so. And so what happens is, because when you sign that divorce agreement, it says right in there that the other spouse will have no claim on your estate. And people interpret that to mean that the person can't get anything from their estate. But that's not what it means. It means they won't make a claim. But if you still have a life insurance policy that names your previous spouse, then being divorced doesn't change that. Or an RSP, like you said, if you have an RSP that names your previous spouse and you never notify the bank that you're divorced and you want to change your beneficiary, it's still there. And being divorced doesn't change it.
Because legally, it looks like you want to leave this person that money.
And you could choose that. I mean, you can't just assume because people got divorced that there was absolutely no reason to leave any money to them. Maybe you did that because, you know, some financial arrangement, you had come out on top. Or maybe you had agreed to it. Or maybe it was for the kids. There can be all kinds of reasons, but you can't assume just because people are divorced that they necessarily intended to change absolutely everything. So if you want to change, you have to do it.
And do you just go to the bank or contact your financial advisor?
Whichever you have. Like if you have a financial advisor, they probably know you're going through a divorce, but you should specifically give instructions about what you want to do with those assets. Because, you know, there's lots of times when people set up a life insurance policy and they don't think about it again for years. And why would they? And when you're going through a divorce and you're trying to think about who's going to have the kids and what are the visiting arrangements going to be and sorting out the house and everything, the life insurance is probably pretty far down the list.
All right. We need to take a quick break here. But when we come back, we are going to talk about what happens if you separated but you didn't get divorced. We'll be right back with The Law Show.
The Law Show will be right back. This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Welcome back to The Law Show with Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. Today we are talking about estate planning for blended families. And before the break, we were talking about how your divorce from your first relationship can impact your estate planning with your current relationship. Now, we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about what happens if you got separated, but you never finalized your divorce. How does that impact your estate planning?
I'm actually surprised how common that is, that people separate and they never do go through the final stages of divorcing. And it can have unexpected outcomes. For example, if you look at a pension, and we all have a public pension, of course, and a lot of people have private pensions through work. What they will do with a company or a government providing a pension, they will look for a spouse. That's where they go first. And if you have a spouse, even though you know you haven't lived with them for 10 years, they're still your spouse. So most likely, they will still get the pension. And maybe that's not where you wanted it to go, but they're your spouse, so that can happen. There's also an issue with the matrimonial home, because in Newfoundland and Labrador, we have rules about the matrimonial home that say that it goes to a surviving spouse. If that was their matrimonial home, they lived in it together, etc. Now, over a long period of time, that might not happen. But let's say you split up and a year later, you're living with somebody new and your common law and you pass away. You know, is your house still the matrimonial home? Does that mean your new spouse has to move out so the old one can take the home? I mean, sometimes these questions come up because you just simply haven't taken care of.
And everything gets more tangled than it would be otherwise.
It gets tangled and, you know, people curse you for the rest of their lives because you've made such a mess and now they've, you know, it's all gone south and they've got to live with it.
So does the new spouse have the same inheritance rights as the former spouse?
Yes, if you're legally married, your new spouse would just simply have the same rights as if you had never been married before in terms of inheriting from your estate. If you have the legal status of married spouse, then yes, you have the same rights as a former spouse would have had.
And in Newfoundland, there's very specific regulations for if you're living common law, right? Common law spouses have no inheritance rights whatsoever.
Yeah, that's right. And that's why I said if you're legally married, you would step into the shoes of a former spouse. But typically what happens if if you split up with somebody and then you don't divorce them, obviously you can't remarry until you do. So a lot of people do go into a common law second relationship or third. And that's exactly right. They don't create the same rights at all. It's very different.
So to take care of that new common law spouse, you would need to make a will, right? And take care of them that way.
Absolutely make a will. Yeah, because when we say that a spouse has no inheritance rights, we're talking about in the absence of a will. So absolutely, you can make a will and you can leave your bank accounts or your investments or your real estate, whatever you want, to your new common law spouse. But in the absence of that will, they get nothing.
And when it comes to incapacity documents, so your enduring power of attorney, your advanced health care directive, how does a common law spouse fit into those documents?
Well, you know, that's such an interesting situation because legally a common law spouse is not a next of kin. And they're not actually legally your family for some situations. And, you know, this is the thing that's complicated about common law is that, you know, they're the parent of your children, perhaps, or they're a tax partner. And for some purposes, they are your spouse, they are your next of kin. But in terms of inheritance law and even incapacity, they're not. So the common law could show up at the hospital because something's happened to you, but the person's mother or father might be there and they're a closer kin or their siblings. And they could be the ones calling the shots and making the decisions and not the person who's the common law spouse, even though they might have been together for years. So you can see how that would be a very hurtful situation to the common law person that can't be involved because they're just not named anywhere.
Especially if, for example, you're in the hospital and you're the one who has been taking care of them up until they were in the hospital and living with them for
sharing their life for a long time.
10 or 15 years that you've been together, and all of a sudden you're out of the picture.
Yeah, that would be pretty hard to handle.
Now, when it comes to joint property, can you arrange your joint property so that your new spouse is taken care of?
Yes, and that's actually a very good planning idea for common laws. For example, when I was talking about married couples and I said that if it's a matrimonial home and it's only owned by one of the partners, on the death of that partner, the other one will automatically get to own the home, treat it like a joint tenancy. That doesn't happen if you're in a common law relationship. So it's more important for people who are in common law relationships to think about how they've got things set up, their home and their bank accounts and those kind of things. If they set them up as joint, then they know that that person will always be able to have that asset.
So if a common law couple goes and sets up a joint bank account, that joint ownership overrides the part where they're common law.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
All right. So we're going to talk about the next piece of the puzzle here, which is the children in a blended family. And quite often when you talk about blended families, you think about there's children from one side, children from the other side, maybe there's children from the two new partners together. And each of these components needs their own consideration when it comes to estate planning. So we're going to take a little bit of a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about how children fit into estate planning for blended families.
The Law Show will be right back. This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Welcome back to The Law Show with Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. Today we are talking about estate planning for blended families. And don't forget, if you would like accurate, up-to-date legal information sent directly to your inbox, sign up for our monthly e-newsletter on our website at butlerwillsandestates.com. At the beginning of every month, we send out a 4 or 5 page newsletter that is absolutely packed with information. We've also got things in there like discount codes for books and that sort of thing. So feel free to go right ahead, sign up for free at butlerwillsandestates.com. Now, getting back to our topic, before the break, we mentioned that we were going to start talking about how children fit into estate planning for blended families. Now, the word children is different in law than it is in the way that we use it sort of in everyday language.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So when it comes to wills, a lot of the time people say, oh, I leave everything to my children. How does that work when it comes to blended families?
The way that it works is that stepchildren are not considered children in a clause like you just said. If I leave everything to my children, that means my biological, my adopted children. It does not include stepchildren. I agree with your statement that it doesn't necessarily mean the same thing in conversation as it does in the law, because if you are talking to somebody who's been in a second relationship for, say, 15 years and has been raising somebody else's children for that amount of time, that person usually considers the children theirs as well. So when they talk about my kids, they're usually talking about all the kids, including the stepchildren, because that's how they think of them in some cases. So what they need to realize is that even if you've raised a child from babyhood, if they're a stepchild, they're not included as legally one of your children. So what that means is that if you want to include that stepchild in your will, you have to start naming names. You can't just say my children, because that one won't be included.
Right, and that makes it a little bit more specific. So you can say my stepchild, Joey. Right, so what if you just said my child, Joey?
I think that would still be okay.
Because the name is there as a qualifier?
Because the name is there. You try not to create confusion in a will by using an incorrect term, but it could happen. And I think given the context and identifying the child by his full name, it would probably still be okay.
Now, does that get a little bit more difficult if, say, for example, you're still having children?
Yeah, it does, because, you know, if you know you're not going to have any more children, because all your kids are teenagers by now, for example, you could name all the names and be relatively sure you're not adding anybody else to the group. But if they're a younger couple and they're still having family of their own, they could say, you know, my children, Joey and Sarah and Jane. And then the next year, Jimmy comes along. So then you have to change your will again. So it's a little trickier, but you can stay on top of it.
In second relationships, sometimes one of the parents doesn't want their stepchildren to inherit anything.
Oh, that's very common. Particularly in older couples where the new spouse has never been in a parental role with the children. These days, people are getting remarried a lot later in life than they used to. So lots of times we see people come in whose children are fully grown. They could be in their 20s, 30s, 40s. And the parent wants their children to inherit the estate rather than the new spouse and the stepchildren.
So it's really a matter of whether or not you choose to include your stepchildren. It's not up to any sort of law as to whether or not you have to.
No, legally you don't owe anything at all to a stepchild. There can be circumstances where a stepchild is a financial dependent, but generally speaking, no, they're not.
And when it comes to your married spouse, can you ever just leave them out of your will and leave everything to your kids?
You can. This is a difficult one. This is the challenge of planning for a state for blended families right there in a nutshell. Because when you marry somebody, legally you have obligations to them, and we have laws that say you have to support your spouse in your will. And if you don't, the spouse has dependent relief rights and can challenge your will. So the challenge for people in blended families is how do you take care of that spouse as you have to do, but how do you make sure that you also leave something to the kids? Because, for example, you know, say you've worked your whole life and, you know, you've got, say, $500,000 in assets and you leave everything to your second spouse, there's nothing stopping that second spouse from leaving everything to his or her kids, or from remarrying and leaving it to those kids, and your kids end up with nothing.
So it's a bit of a balancing act between
your
difference.
That's exactly what it is. It's a balance. And each case is different because the family structure is different and the assets are different and the wishes are different. But yeah, this is the core of the challenge for blended families.
So what are some of the options for accomplishing that balance?
Well, there's a couple of choices. There's the simplest way, I suppose, is to divide up the assets in the way that makes the most sense. For example, if you have an RRSP, say you've got an RRSP that's worth $50,000 and you've got $50,000 in the bank, and you say to yourself, I'm going to go half the spouse and half my son. If you leave the $50,000 in the RRSP to your wife, say, there's no tax on that, so they get $50,000 because you're rolling it over.
Because it's going to a spouse.
Exactly. And then you leave the $50,000 to the child. But if you switch that around and you gave the RSP to the child, then all of a sudden you're going to lose up to 40% of that in tax. So when you're allocating assets between different parties, you have to think about, you know, think it through and see how far it goes and what makes the most sense.
See what your best options are.
That's
for
right.
Dividing everything up.
Yeah.
All right, we need to take another break, but when we come back, we are going to talk about adoption. We'll be right back with The Law Show.
The Law Show. We'll be right back. This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Welcome back to The Law Show with Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. Right before the break, we were talking about some of the estate planning solutions for balancing your obligations between your spouse and your children, and some of the different ways that you can make sure that what you want to have happen does happen. Now, Lynn, there's the way that you can use trusts in estate planning for blended families. How does that work?
Trusts are used a lot for blended families. And in the context that we were talking about, between balancing between your kids and your new spouse, trusts are frequently used there. And the basic idea behind it is you can take the assets that you own and put them in a trust so that when you pass away, your new spouse can use those assets for the rest of his or her life. This works particularly well with the house and contents. So you could say, for example, you know, I own the house and I want my kids to have this house, but I also want my spouse to have somewhere to live. So you just put it in trust with a bit of money for maintenance. And so the spouse can live there until either she passes away or she remarries or whatever terms you put on the trust. And they are your choice, what terms you put on there. And then once that contingency happens, then the house or whatever the asset is can pass to your children. So that way you've balanced off her needs or his needs and what you want to do for the kids.
So you can still provide for that spouse while he or she is alive, but make sure that in the end it goes to your children.
Yeah, the asset is preserved, right? And you can also say in the trust things like who's going to pay expenses and who's going to do what. So the trusts are used that way because they're really flexible and they work really well in blended families.
Now, we mentioned before that when it comes to children, stepchildren are not legally your children, right? Your biological children are, of course, your children, but adopted children are also your children.
Because
that's right. Legally, when the adoption goes through, they're basically the same as children that you've had yourself.
Yes, exactly right. Once that you have legally adopted somebody, and we're not just talking about someone that you bring into the house and go, you know, we're going to look after this person because they're family and, you know, we're going to say they're our child. And sometimes that still does happen where you just kind of take in somebody who needs to be taken in. We're not talking about that. We're talking about a legal adoption. And yes, once they're adopted, they're the same as your child for every legal purpose. So including inheritance.
And how common is it for people to formally adopt, say, their stepchildren?
Not very common. Most people don't do it. Occasionally it happens when when a stepchild is very young, usually a baby, and they may adopt them. But realistically, that child usually still has another parent somewhere else who does not want their child to be adopted by a new parent. They still want to be a parent.
Well, and when thinking about, for example, my situation, you know, I'm the second wife for my husband. He has a daughter. She's 15.
Yeah.
Right. She lives with her mother and her stepfather. So why would I adopt her when she has a full family already?
Yeah, that's right. And even if you did want to, her mother would never permit it. So there's lots of reasons like that, that people generally don't. And they sometimes don't even think of it. You know, everyone's happy where they are, so why fix it if it's not broken?
I think it's sort of that attitude of a piece of paper isn't going to change our relationship.
Yes, I hear that kind of thing a lot. And it doesn't change the relationship, but it sure changes the legal outcomes.
So it's definitely something to think about when you're doing your estate planning, is how that piece of the puzzle comes into it.
Yes, and it does, because what happens these days is that children who have been adopted look for and often find their biological parents years later. And then they develop a relationship with them, and they feel, because now they're kind of back in the fold, you know, they're back with their biological parents. When the biological parent passes away, the child who's been adopted by someone doesn't get anything from that parent's estate.
Because legally they're not that
person's
child.
They're not their child anymore. So they basically have the status of a friend at that point. And like I said earlier, we're talking about in the absence of a will. They don't get anything. So this biological parent who gave somebody up for adoption is perfectly able to make a will and leave something to that child.
Because you can leave whatever you want to whoever
friends.
You want.
Sure, you
in
could.
Your will.
And pretty close.
Basically.
Yeah. Yeah. But in the absence of a will, the child who's been adopted by someone else has no right to insist on anything.
So you wouldn't have the same dependent relief that you would if you had never been adopted.
Assuming you're,
say, 17, you're a minor,
yeah,
and your biological parent passes away, but you've been adopted by someone else.
There's no dependent relief available there. Yeah.
So when it comes to estate planning for blended families, making a will seems to be the key for sorting everything out and making sure that things go according to plan.
It certainly is, yeah. It's definitely a tool that blended families must use for their estate planning, because the default laws don't work in their favor. You should have a will, and there's other things to do as well, of course, but the will is an absolute must.
So one of the first challenges when it comes to making a will for a blended family, and I suppose the first challenge for anybody making a will, is naming an executor. Yeah. Why is it more difficult for blended families to name an executor?
For most married couples, their first choice of an executor is their spouse. And that makes perfect sense, right? A couple is married and the spouse is going to be, if not the only beneficiary, then a major one. And that's fine. They are also the parent of the children. In a blended family, there's not necessarily a relationship between the new parent or the new spouse and your children from the previous relationship. And sometimes the relationship is even hostile. So it doesn't work well if you put that spouse in charge of assets that are going to the children.
All right, we need to take another break, but when we come back, we are going to continue our discussion about using a will in your estate planning for blended families.
The Law Show will be right back. This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Welcome back to The Law Show with Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. We are continuing our conversation about estate planning for blended families. And before the break, we mentioned that naming an executor is a huge challenge for people on a second relationship, because the type of relationship is different. You know, for example, that there may not be a relationship with your stepchildren, and if there is, it could potentially be a negative one. In some cases, it's hostile.
Yeah, and I think that becomes more exaggerated when the assets are being split between people and the executor has a lot of discretion about which assets go where. It's hard to please everyone, as any executor out there knows. It's hard to please anyone. But if someone has a predisposition to not like you or to somehow have a resentment against you, it really doesn't make the job any easier.
Well, and we've mentioned on previous shows that sometimes childhood disagreements come into play when it's,
yeah,
when the time comes to divide assets and one person's the executor. So when there's that added factor of maybe you didn't get along as children, or you felt like things were different because one of you was a stepchild.
That's right. And when it comes to older children, if the children were teenagers or older when the parents split up, sometimes they resent the fact that their parent has gone into this new relationship, because they may even blame the new partner for the breakup of the family. So there's all those kinds of interfamily dynamics going on, you know, behind the scenes.
Now, one of the options that unfortunately a lot of people choose is what we call the team captain approach, where one child from one side of the family is one co-executor, and a child from the other side of the family is the second co-executor, and they're expected to work together.
This is really common. Like you said, a lot of people seem to like that arrangement. I don't like it. The idea is that each side has a say and they get along and they work together. But what they don't seem to realize is that when you pick one from one side and one from the other side, you're basically saying, we're not really one family. You're two teams here, and you each need protection from the other. And it tends to actually pit people against each other rather than fostering cooperation between them. And just the fact that you've got a representative makes it feel as if you're in a dispute or a fight or some kind of struggle, because you've got to have somebody looking after you. So I find that just the dynamic of acknowledging that there's two sides and you're not one family tends to create a lot of tension right off the bat.
Well, sure, you've divided everybody right down the middle.
Yeah.
After years of saying we're one unit now, we're a team, we're a family, all of a sudden that's not true anymore.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's a big slap in the face for a lot of people.
So one of the options that we find works really well is to use a trust company.
Yeah, for blended families, depending on the size of the estate, a trust company is a great solution. And part of the reason is, we talked about trusts earlier, and we said that a house, for example, could be held in trust so that the new spouse could live there until he or she passes away. And how long is that going to be? 20, 30, 40 years? Who do you have in your family or your friends that is able to or willing to look after a trust for that long? So just for the fact that the trusts are so long, makes a trust company a good idea.
Well, and a huge bonus is the fact that the trust companies are neutral.
That's right.
They're not attached to one side of the family more than the other, or one child more than the others.
That's right. The neutrality is definitely a good point.
And having a neutral third party, even in a traditional nuclear family where there's disagreement, can work really well. But
that's
in
true.
A situation where you've got two sides that are, so to speak, at war over your estate.
Well, I wish more people in blended families would realize that when they are gone, they're the linchpin between their new spouse and the children. And once they're gone, the relationship, even if it's okay, it does change. It gets worse. And if it never existed in the first place, I could tell you horror stories about the way that people have treated each other once that spouse is gone, the spouse who's the parent of the children is gone. And people would be horrified if they knew the way that people treat each other. So it's a really good idea to get somebody neutral if you can.
And when it comes to blended families, the will of someone in a blended family is more likely to contain a trust than the will of someone who's not in a blended family.
Yes, I think that's true.
Because it's such a useful tool for making sure that you are making the most out of your assets.
That's right. And I find that people in general, when they're doing their will planning, one of the first things they say to me is, things are very simple. And I know they're not very simple. They only seem simple to people because they haven't yet thought about all the problems that could happen. And people think that having a trust in your will makes it very complicated, that it makes the document itself complicated and it makes the estate complicated. But that's absolutely not true. It may add another couple of paragraphs to your will, so it doesn't complicate the actual document. And when it comes to your estate, it can actually make things quite a bit easier. I want to tell people, don't shy away from the idea because it seems complicated. It really is not. All a trust means is that something's being held onto for someone else. And as long as the person knows what it is they're trying to do, who they're trying to benefit, a trust can be written pretty easily.
And if you find that a trust seems overwhelming, make sure that you find an experienced estate lawyer who can explain the ins and outs of that trust to you.
Yes, and you should be able to read it yourself and understand it without a lawyer or a judge in the room with you.
That legalese.
That's right.
Needs to be able to stay out of it.
That's right.
All right, we need to take another break, but when we come back, we are going to finish our discussion about using estate planning for blended families.
The Law Show. We'll be right back. This is The Law Show with Butler Wills and Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
Welcome back to The Law Show with Lynn and Chelsea from Butler Wills and Estates. Today we are talking about estate planning for blended families. And before the break, we left off, we were talking about using a trust in your estate planning for a blended family and how a lot of the time people sort of shy away from trusts because they seem like they're too complicated or they're too much work or it's something that just hasn't ever been thoroughly explained. So people think that they shouldn't be using them.
Well, they tend to think that they're for millionaires or, you know, trust fund kids that have millions put away and that kind of thing. But it's definitely not restricted to that. For most of us, can be very useful, even if all you have is a house, which, you know, most people have, that can be held in a trust, like you said, particularly if that's your only asset and you really want to hand that to your kids, then it's the perfect tool for that. So,
and you can tailor a trust to fit the different circumstances that you're in. They're not cookie cutter.
Oh, they're not templates. Cookie cutter at all. Everyone needs to be written individually. When it comes to, say, the house that we've been talking about quite a bit, you can say, for example, in your trust, when the trust comes to an end, what happens to the house exactly? Do all the kids' names get put on it? Do they sell it and split the money? You know, what if one of the kids has passed? Do their kids get a share? So you can address all of those things because you know a lot of years are going to pass. And then you want to be specific about what is going to end the trust. You know, you know, we've said, what if she moves out? Well, what if she moves out for a week? Or what if she moves out to a long-term care? Has she really moved out? Is it still her home? So you can be specific about all of these things and tailor them to your specific family.
Well, and especially if what you're trying to do is keep your assets between your spouse and your children, right? If your spouse remarries, you don't want the new guy getting your house, right?
Probably
not. So you could say, for example, you know, if my wife remarries, the trust comes to an end and the house moves on to my children.
Yeah, and you know, she might not remarry. What if she lives with them common law? So you think things through, right? You just talk it through and find, what are your goals? I mean, some people say, I don't care if she remarries. I want her to have this house as long as she lives. Other people say, most people say, no, if she remarries, then I want the house. That's a good time for it to go to my kids.
And those are all options that you can discuss with your estate planning lawyer when you go in for your meeting to talk about what you want in your documents.
Well, this is why when I meet people to plan a will, the first conversation, particularly with people who are in a blended family, is probably an hour, because there's a lot of these things to talk through. It's not a 5-minute, you know, who would you like to name your will? Okay, thanks, bye. I mean, you really have to talk through the pros and cons, the options, the choices.
Well, and it's also why filling in a form and calling it a day isn't going to cover what you need it to.
No, you need more than that when it's coming to estate planning. You need to be advised.
Now, what happens when it comes to trusts for children?
Well, you know, blended families have some of the same issues as all families do. And one of those issues is children who are minors. So obviously they can't inherit, so their shares are held in trust. So that's not specific to blended families, but it's with any family with minor children. So sometimes, yeah, there'll also be trusts for children.
And as with the other trusts that we were talking about, you can set the requirements however you want. You have to be a minimum of 19 years old to inherit, but that doesn't mean you have to get everything at 19. You could set it up, say, for example, you get a third at 19, a third at 25, and a third at 30.
Yeah, you can set it up however you feel will work for your kids, depending on how much is in the trust. I mean, you might treat $10,000 differently than you treat $1 million. So that's part of it. I have seen people, for example, say that their kids' shares are to be held in trust until the child is 65. And the reason they did that is they felt their child, even though he was working, was never saving a dime and wasn't going to have anything for retirement. And so what they figured was the best use of their assets was to fund their child's retirement. Now, that's pretty unusual. You very rarely see anybody say 65. But you're right, not everybody gets everything at 19 because it's not the best use of that asset.
But that's one of those situations where a trust company would come in handy. Who who do you know in your family that's going to hold money in trust until your 15-year-old child is 65?
Yeah.
Right, that's a really long time.
Yeah, and again, it's a discussion, right? Maybe you have someone in your family, maybe you don't, but until you actually think about it and talk about it, you don't really know.
And one of the things that we definitely want to mention is that we've talked before about the prices for our wills package, right? So you get a will, an enduring power of attorney, and an advanced healthcare directive for one price. That fee does not change when it comes to including trusts or planning for a blended family.
No, they don't, because I don't find adding one or two trusts to a will makes it incredibly complicated. There are some wills that cost more, but I think in the time that we've been open, we've never had a will that went over and above our regular price. Mm-hmm. It's just not that much more complicated.
Well, and regular price, as you mentioned, for an individual is $550. For a couple, whether you're married, common law, second relationship, third relationship, whatever it is $650.
That's right.
And that's total, not each.
That's right.
And of course, there are taxes on that, the inevitable taxes.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to including a trust or planning for mixing your families together, it doesn't change because it's still one meeting. It's still your situation. It still needs to be talked about in that first meeting when you come in.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. We have reached the end of this show, but if you have questions that you would like us to answer on the air, send an email to thelawshow@nl@gmail.com. And if you are looking for a great resource to get started on your own estate planning, check out Lynn's book, The No-Nonsense Real-Life Guide to Estate Planning, which is available in our office and on our website at butlerwillsandestates.com.
If you have a question or comment for The Law Show, email onair@vocm.com. This has been The Law Show with Butler, Wills & Estates on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.
The proceeding was a paid program on the VOCM Big Land FM radio network.